And the observation was that standard model looks like an effective field theory because what you expect to get in effective field theory, as you've seen, is that when you integrate out the physics at density time scale, you expect to get pretty much all possible things at low energies, all possible interactions at low energies that are consistent with the particle content and the selection rules of the field theory. And you expect to get it with kind of coefficients which are set by the scaling dimensions of the various interactions. And so the standard model has that property almost. So the standard model, remember, was at the dimension zero level. It was square root of minus g. There was a constant. I don't remember what I called it last time. It's called C2. Dimension zero. And the only thing we had that had dimension two was this big squared term. This is what we call, what we would have called u squared in the standard model. And there's a whole bunch of dimension four terms. So that's things like, you know, psi bar d slash psi, cow couplings, psi bar higgs. Gauge kinetic terms, FPNU. Scalar kinetic terms. And that's the fourth term. These are all dimension four. And if the next scale of physics was some scale much bigger than the ones we had access to, you'd expect things to stop here.
H degree squared, right?
Oh, yeah, thanks. You'd expect that a good description of what we see should be what you'd get if you stopped here. And it is true. The standard model is a good description of almost everything we see. So that's kind of in itself is substantial evidence that whatever we're missing is heavy. The loophole in that argument would be if it was could have been light but very weakly coupled, so for some reason you're not seeing it. Because the graviton is like that. The graviton is something not on this list. We know it's there, it's weakly coupled, but we still know it's there. Because in some circumstances that decoupling isn't competing with something else that's bigger. And so we don't know for sure there's not other things that are like that. Are very weak coupled with another light. It's going to be very weak coupled with any other. So the fact that you're getting everything possible, the standard model is the most general thing you could have had that would normalize both, is part of what makes you think that it's probably an effective theory. We know that there is physics at higher scales. We know that this scale, C2, is something like 240, say, something like 100 GeV squared. Exact value depends on the size of the big cell coupling. But we know there are other scales in life that are bigger than that, and most notably the Planck scale, which would be 5 g minus 1/2, that's something like 10 to the 18 GeV. So it's plausible there are things that are at higher energies. The energies involved would be very much higher, so it would be a good approximation to collect them. Doesn't mean that things that we're neglecting are suppressed by this, because we've seen that the smallest mass that we've been neglecting is the one that will dominate. It's allowed to contribute given selection rules. Because everything we're not writing is suppressed by a mass, and so the smallest mass of the denominator will win. And that's not true for these guys. I guess also the thing I should have also written here in dimension two is n Planck squared R. That's the Einstein term. And really, that should be in the standard model because it's a particle that we know and love, and it's something whose we can calculate with. And that'll be the next topic, is how to calculate in quantum level terminology. But the expectation for effective field theory is that things that are positive power to masses should be dominated by the biggest mass of the problem. that certainly seems to be true for this case. This is the biggest mass scale we know about in nature. But it doesn't seem to be true for these ones. So these things are not protected by any symmetries that we know about. There are symmetries that could protect you from these, but not that many symmetries that can protect you from these. Eternal symmetries typically won't protect you from having contributions to these things. And so generically, we would have expected them to be as big as this term. And one of the puzzles of the hard. So two of the hierarchy problems in the model are true. Why is it true that these two scales are so small? These are all technical nationalist problems. Sometimes they're called, more often I guess they're called hierarchy problems. One way of saying it. And that's actually not the best, but that's why they're often said. People will often say that this is C0 is experimentally known to be of the order of 10 to the minus 122 Planck units. So people call that the worst possible prediction in history. And it's true that if your prediction was in Planck to the fourth, you could have said that was what you were dealing with. But the main thing I want to argue now is that there's lots of ways in which to solve these problems to understand why these things are not bigger than the weak scales, say. And what that has to do with is what the physics is that appears, whatever the next physics is that we've ignored, depending on its properties, it can be such that there is no large quantum really the same bigger than 100 GeV level. So probably a more robust statement of this problem would be that the real problem is why isn't this in units of 100 GeV to the fourth? You know, the Planck scale is 10 to the 18, so we've come down by 10 to the 16. 4 times is 64. So we should be doing 64 orders of magnitude better, right? So it's 10 to the minus 64 would have been 58. This is the real problem, I think, is that there are ways in which we could modify the physics we haven't seen yet to understand why this thing is the least scale of the fourth power. What's difficult to understand is why it's not set by there's particles we already know about in the standard model, which should be contributing way too large amounts to this. If we use the electron mass here at the fourth power, we'd still be off by 36 orders of magnitude. So there's lots of what makes this where I want to go is I want to argue that C0 is a hard problem because the scales that you expect to be contributing are the scales which we think we understand already. Whereas for C2, it's less of a pressing problem in the sense that we don't have a problem with any of the particles that are here already. They will be contributing things that are at most this large because that's how big the mass there are in this particle because they're getting their masses from this particle. So whether there's a problem at higher energies depends on whether that physics at higher energies gives you large contributions to these terms or not. And there's ways of designing. Generically, it will give you large contributions, but remember the statement was we expect to get the power of the heaviest scale possible that's consistent with selection rules and symmetries and things, so it might be there's a symmetry that saves us. So I want to go through the options as to how we can avoid this problem. But it's all to do with, the point is that whether there's a problem or not depends on what's beyond the standard model, and so it's a good way to guide yourself into thinking is what should be beyond the standard model, worrying about how big this thing is. But it's not a pressing problem with what we already know. Yeah. So for C0, you want to know why C0 is so small as 10 to the minus 2 electron volts to the fourth.
62, we want to know y is 62.
And so I want to phrase this in a there's two aspects of the problem. Why is it, anytime someone gives you a number which you don't understand the size of, and one way to think about these numbers is in terms of dimensionless ratios. The problem is that the ratio of this number is really, really, really small. That's 10 to the minus 58. The ratio of this number to this number is really, really small. That's 10 to the minus 30. And so it's unusual to get very, very, very small dimensionless numbers. And so there's two aspects to understanding why you have a small number. One of them is, you know, in the theory of the world, what was it that happened to choose for you that small number? So if we understood what was going on at higher energies, maybe there's a reason why the physics of very high energies likes to give you a small number for that. That's one part of it, the problem. But the second part of the problem is, you know, we've seen that this thing is supposed to be emerging as we integrate out, it's appearing as we integrate out particles that are heavier than the standard model. So the statement is, you know, there's probably more than one particle out there to be integrated out. And so the second part of the problem is that if somebody tells you at very, very high energies that this parameter is small, you're measuring it at low energies. And so as you integrate out particle after particle coming down to the energies that you would want to be at to where you are describing the experiments that measure the small number, you want to know why is the small number you were given at high energies stable under that process of removing and matching across the thresholds corresponding to many, many different kinds of particles. And there's nothing, it's not a theorem that, it's not mathematically inconsistent to choose maybe this is something I should say, let's actually not the calculation, but basically the criterion that a small parameter stays small as you integrate out physics from high to low energies is the statement is the condition that it be technical naturalness. Technical naturalness. A small parameter is technically natural if it's true that its smallness is preserved as you integrate out particle after particle. The only which is I'm going to make precise in a second. So this the first topic is kind of what is technical naturalness and what's the problem here? So I want to start off with what's not the problem. So the zero thing is it's often phrased in terms of divergences, that if you take the standard model you calculate things, you calculate the corrections to these coefficients. What's kind of different between a dimension 4 term and these lower dimension terms is that the ultraviolet divergences you get here tend to be logarithmic cutoff, and these things will tend to be powers of the cutoff if you put in a cutoff. And that, I want to argue, is not what the issue is. So, for example, if we had calculated in the standard model the effects of a Hayes loop, say, on C2, so we calculate the correction to C2 coming from taking the Hayes and doing the graph of that, say, then that would have been proportional to an integral d4p 2 pi to the fourth loop. We've got a couple in here, which is basically lambda, and lambda 5 to the fourth, the lambda h to the fourth here. And there would have been a propagator, which would have been something like 1 over p squared plus m x squared. And you can see that this thing is 4 powers of momentum in the numerator, 2 in the denominator, if we were, it's diverging for large p, and if we cut it off at a scale lambda, that would go like something like lambda, coupling loss at lambda times cutoff lambda squared over just angular integrals we do in here, which turns that into 16 pi squared. That's the, basically the solid angle in four space dimensions is pi squared. And so it's often the statement is that the corrections to these things depend strongly on the cutoff. And so that means that the renormalized value of C2 renormalized, which was some bare value C2 bare, with delta C2 went to the loops. This is the thing whose value is 100 GV to the fourth. This is the thing we just calculated. Only like lambda squared, which will be big if lambda is very large. So the statement about being, what makes people uncomfortable with this kind of a correction is that they would say that, well, so then this thing has to be huge. And the sum of these two things has to be very small, so there's an enormous cancellation going on. So supposing that lambda was at the end of the 10 GV, just to choose a number, and that's 10 to the 8 times bigger than this. So this, when we square it, that's 10 to the 16 times bigger than the square. So the value you'd have to choose for this counterterm, according to this way of arguing things, would have to be canceling with the corrections to 16 decimal places or better to get the value that you'd like to measure in the experiment. And so what's wrong with that? That kind of has much of the spirit of what the problem is. But what's wrong with that in detail is that the one thing you know about this cutoff is that it's not in the answer. One of the lessons of effective field theories was that, you know, where do these cutoffs come from? In the full theory, you calculate something, and then if you integrate out all the heavy particles down to some cutoff lambda, that defines for you what your effective theory is, and we're imagining that's where the standard model came from. So all our coupling constants are functions of lambda in that way. And then these kind of graphs are coming when we do the low energy particle calculation from zero energy to lambda, and they're depending on lambda in this way. But this dependence is exactly what we need to cancel the dependence that's in the coupling constants in the Lagrangian to start with, because we know that the whole answer was the interval from zero to whatever this high scale was, and lambda is just really an artifact of the way we're calculating. We're just choosing to do the intervals in steps down to lambda, stop, look at Lagrangian, and then do the rest of the interval down to zero. And in that second step is where we're seeing this thing. And the one thing we know about lambda is that it's not in the problem, so it's guaranteed to cancel between couplings to Lagrangian and these explicit ones we're finding in these loops. So then, given that, we shouldn't really care too much if we find that there's a cancellation, because that cancellation was free. That the it doesn't make much sense to worry about the bigness of something which is not. It's like taking a, you can do this artificially anywhere you want. You can calculate your favorite thing and add to it a million and subtract a million and say, oh gee, wasn't it amazing that the second subtraction of a million just exactly canceled the million I added to it before? And then saying it that way, it sounds like it's just a silly thing to worry about. So although this is often the way that the naturalness problems are phrased, I want to argue here that this is not the problem. It's because lambda is really not a physical answer. It captures, the reason people make this argument is that this captures the flavor of the real argument I want to give you, because it's mostly relying on dimensional analysis. It's saying that some big mass can appear in the answer in a way which is sensitive to that mass. And that's kind of the spirit of what the problem is, that these low dimension couplings, which are going on the positive power of the mass, we figure the biggest mass in the problem is going to dominate in its contribution to those things. And so to the extent you're doing dimensional analysis and you're saying that the cutoff is a proxy for some big mass in the problem, then this is not getting it too wrong. But because people are not critical about this argument, they start to overanalyze these divergences. And, you know, and if one of the people who came to the part of this talk, there was a talk a couple of weeks ago where somebody was arguing about the sign of these divergences and then drawing a physical conclusion because they were relating that sign to another sign that they could go out and measure. And the sign of something like this is something which there you're not relying anymore on dimensional analysis, you're relying on the details of what the numerical coefficient is. And there's no guarantee that the numerical coefficient of a cutoff, you know, if you have somebody does for you a divergent calculation, supposing we have a small scale and we have a big scale, and we calculate something which is dimensions of mass squared. So we calculate some observable as a function of m and m. And we find that there's a contribution which goes like m squared, another contribution that goes like capital M squared. And this is the biggest one, say. So let's say this is the physical answer. And these will all be renormalized masses, because this is a physical observable, and we've done all the, there's no regularization left in the problem. But now imagine we do this calculation where we stick cut up in between, and we look at the high energy part and the low energy part. And in that case, we write this as being a low energy piece plus a high energy piece. And the low energy piece can depend on m and lambda, because that's all that's in that problem. And the high energy piece can depend on lambda and m, because that's what's in that problem. And so what you find is that this low energy piece is where this piece comes from. And there'll be some piece which is divergent, typically, so there'll be some coefficient c to the lambda squared, plus maybe other things that are smaller. Maybe there's a lambda m term. The high energy piece, it'll have this piece in it. And it'll have to have a piece which cancels this, because that's guaranteed. And then there's other things. And so it's true that this plus this gives you the physical answer. But the problem with over-interpreting cutoffs is that you're looking at this coefficient and saying, oh, if I calculate that coefficient, I can calculate that in the low energy theory alone. The assumption is that that's telling you something with that coefficient, which is what you really care about the answer. And they don't have to be related to each other. People often have the intuition that they will be related to each other. And that intuition is based on logarithmic divergences. If you made the same argument for a logarithmic divergence, then what you would have found is supposing we had rho is equal to a plus b log of m squared over m squared. Let's say there's a big logarithm in the answer. We want to follow that. And again, if you wrote the low energy plus the high energy part, same way, the low energy part maybe has some constant. Let's call it c. Plus, you could have a log divergent piece. Let's call it c hat. Log of lambda divided by m. So that's what I can say. And then it's going to be a high energy piece, which will be some other constant, call it k plus k hat log of m divided by lambda. If these things are going to add together, it has to be true that c plus k is equal to a. And if these things are going to have the lambdas cancel, it has to be true that c hat and k hat are both equal to b. So it happens that for logarithmic convergence, if you're interested in seeing how things depend on this logarithmic, this large ratio of masses logarithmically, the coefficient of that logarithm, you can calculate purely the low energy theory by keeping track of the log divergence. And because of the fact that logarithms, the way the logarithms cancel, the cancellation of the log of the cutoff between this term and this term requires these coefficients to be the same in the high energy and low energy theory. And so it's a special feature of logarithms that you can work purely in the low energy theory, identify a divergence, pick off its coefficient, and draw a conclusion about a physical large logarithm in your answer. And because most people's experience is with logarithmic divergences, they tend to generalize this to power divergences where it's not true anymore, as you can kind of see from this argument here. But these coefficients do not be related to the coefficient b. So whatever the issue is with naturalness, it's not cutoffs, because what you really want to know is how physical things depend on physical mass scales. In this effective field theory prescription we've got, we could have done use dimensional regularization. In fact, we're crazy not to use dimensional regularization, and there is no cutoff. So if that underlines that following a cutoff is a silly thing to do, because it sounds like it then depends on exactly how you choose to regulate things, whether you have a problem or not. Nothing physical can depend on how you choose to regulate things. So that's my speech. So the right thing to do is what we've been doing right along for this effective field theory. So what we should do is we should calculate the effective field theory or normalized in your favorite way above some threshold. What we're trying to do is follow these masses, either logarithms of masses, powers of masses, and so on. And so what we want to do is we want to calculate the normalized parameters in the effective field theory above some threshold for the mass we're trying to follow, and then calculate the parameters in the effective field theory below that threshold and match them the way we've been describing. So that's all normalized, it's all involving the normalized parameters, so regularizations don't play any role at all. And then the kinds of things we're interested in following in that prescription will be large masses are going to appear in the low energy theory through their contributions to the effective couplings in the low energy theory that are there because they are, the effective couplings in the low energy theory are there in order to describe what the heavy particles are doing. So if the heavy particles are giving a big effect, then the couplings in the low energy theory will describe that effect. But the thing you're trying to follow is the mass dependence of those couplings. And so to the extent that you're using dimensional analysis, the kinds of things you're going to get to won't be so different from what you've got from looking at how things diverge. But if you're thinking about the coefficients, it's sloppy to think about how things diverge because you have to keep in mind that you're using divergences as a proxy for physical masses. And so what we should do is the real question, the real issue, is to track how heavy large tank physical scales up in observables are tracking how they appear in the effective field theory at low energy. So an important conceptual shift that you're forced to do in this case is you're forced to actually think about what the physics was at high energies in order to calculate what you're interested in. Whereas a divergence you could do purely in the low energy theory and never actually ask what's the particle content of the high energy theory. So let's suppose this requires some assumptions. The physics of heavy scale. So for example, it's often true, one of the things you could imagine replacing the standard model at high energies is a grand unified theory. And there you're imagining that the gauge group SE3 cross SE2 cross U1 sits inside some bigger gauge group, which is a simple gauge group like SU5 or SO10. And because of that, there's only one gauge coupling in. So unlike SE3 plus SE2 plus U1, where you have the freedom to separately choose gauge couplings for each factor, you'll have one prediction for the gauge couplings, and then you'll have to learn what the three that we measure, there should be a relationship amongst them because they're all coming from one underlying theory. So let's suppose, just for the sake of argument, that physics above standard model or beyond the standard model in the grand unified theory. And I'll take it as an example, SU5, because it's a simple one to describe. And I'm not going to use much of it, I'm just going to use one feature by rule. So the two things you need to know with this are that so for SU5, so I want to argue what this means. So how does this? This is a statement about what the other particles are that we have included in the standard model. And there's also implicit in that a statement as to how high the physics is that we're ignoring. So, new particles. What are the new particles? The new particles, you can see because SU5 is a set of 5x5 unitary matrices. So imagine that you get a 5-component object, then if you multiply it by unitary matrix with the unit determinant, that's U5 would have been the unitary matrix, and SU5 is the ones with the unit determinant. So we're looking for a way to think of the standard model SU3 cross SU2 cross U1 as being a subset of this 5x5 thing. And the way to do that is just to think of thinking of the top 3x3 piece and the bottom 2x2 piece as being the SU3 and the SU2. And then we need to find a U1 that can use for both of these, and the one to use is one that's basically unit matrix up here and the unit matrix down here. So the U1 we'll say is just generator will be the one which is something important to the one here, something important to the one here. Typically, what I'm writing here now is a generator, not a generator. So when I write the group element as being e to the I omega times y, I'm writing down y. Because of this property, the determinant of these matrices is 1, that means that these generators have to be traceless. So I have to demand that whatever the coefficient of 1 is here, so if I write this as being A times 1, 0, 0, B times 1, this is a 3x3 1, this is a 2x2 1. A constraint on A and B is that's a 3A plus 2B should be 0. That's the trace of Y, that should be 0, because that's part of living inside SU5. That's the determinant 1 condition. So if I think of what the hypercharge is, so there's some freedom now into what A is. So choosing the hypercharge is like choosing the electric charge of things. And so in SU5, the idea will be that we'll take all the particles that we had. So we had forks, doublets, we had lepton doublets, we had right-handed up forks, right-handed down forks, right-handed leptons, we had gauge fields, and we had Higgs. So what you do in SU5 is you try and arrange these particles into multiplets of SU5 such that their quantum numbers under SU3 plus SU2 plus U1 are the ones that we know and love. And one of the amazing things with SU5 is that you can do that just with the particles we know, the fermions we know, and nothing else. And these things group themselves into two representations of SU5. And one of the simple ones is the one that sits here. We're looking for something which is a doublet under SU2 and a triplet under SU3. Which would be related to one another, and so the doublet under SU2 is a singlet under SU3, so that has to be the leptons. And the thing that's up here has to be a singlet under SU2, a triplet under SU3, so it has to have, either the up quarks or the down quarks. And the way to decide is that we now know the hypercharge. If this is a lepton doublet, the hypercharge of the leptons was a half. This is it depends on if it's left-handed or right-handed. These are the left-handed guys. Left-handed electron, remember it's the neutrino, the electron. And so that's a neutral, that's a minus, and so it's minus half. So that means that that was what we needed in order to have Q, which is Y plus T3, to be 0 for this and minus 1 for that. So that means if y is minus a half, that's told us what b is. That means that b, what I really told you is what the hypercharge was for these two guys. That's what b is. So this tells me that then a has to be 1/3. So what we're looking for up here is somebody who is hypercharged 1/3, and that's a singlet under SU2, so that means the charge is its hypercharge. So we're looking for the charge. Minus 1/3 antiquark. And minus one, the antiquark is the charge of minus 1/3 quark, which is the d bar. So that's how you think of SU3 cross SU2 cross U1 sitting inside SU5. Here's an example of how fields, matter fields, can be arranged into an SU5 transformation, which or SU5 representation, which when you think of it in terms of the subgroup SU3 cross SU2 cross U1, agrees with the charge assigned to the standard model. There's a similar one, so we've taken care of these guys. But there's a similar one which relates to those guys, which is a 10-dimensional representation. And I'm not going to follow that up. But the Higgs doesn't fit that way. But you can imagine that the Higgs has a hypercharge which is like leptons. You can imagine that for the Higgs, there's some other particle which we haven't discovered yet, which is somebody who could be living in the top part of a 5-dimensional thing. And we can imagine there's a big field psi, which is that some 3-component thing phi, and then the standard model p down here. And then that would have, if it was transforming like these guys were, this thing would look like a scalar quark. It would be something with the third charge, and it would be colored. And we can imagine this is something which is kind of massive, just big enough that we haven't seen it yet. And so the, whereas the fermions group themselves into SU5 representations, the Higgsons don't. And that's something which you can imagine being fairly natural, because nothing protects scalar masses. That's one of the natural issues we're talking about. So you, the funny thing is to find a light scalar, not to find a heavy scalar. So if this thing were heavy, it's not really, that in itself isn't a problem. This is some sort of heavy exotic. So here's a picture of a kind of new physics which is motivated by something. And it points to the kind of specific kinds of properties, particles with specific kinds of properties at very high energies. How high are the energies? The second thing that you get from this particular picture is where this physics is supposed to happen. So the main idea there is that the gauge couplings, they all, because all these guys are living inside SE5, they have the same gauge coupling. But we measure the three gauge couplings for each of these factors to be very different. And that's supposed to be understood as being due to the normalization group, that they were all at some scale equal to one another, and then they all came down to lower energies and they diverged from one another. So G1, G2, G5, there's a normalization factor here, actually. This is a number that appears for G1. Just because the traditional way you normally have a normalization convention when you take generators of SF5, and this is not satisfying it, so you have to scale a little bit to make it satisfy the same. And normally you demand a trace of TA, TB would be a half, something like that, in the final representation. My choice of Y doesn't satisfy that, so I have to scale it to make it all the same.
What's breaking SU5 in this case?
There'd be some Higgs somewhere which breaks it. You have to look at that. So you have to design that somewhere.
Okay.
And what I'm trying to get to is you know something about the scale where that happens, because just from the fact that we know these couplings are so different from one another. So this is true at scale where SU5 gets broken. SU3, SU2, SU1. We know that it has to get broken, because if it didn't get broken, the quarks and the leptons would have the same mass. So if the symmetry is not broken, then things that are related by it should have the same mass, and they don't. There should also be gauge bosons, because off diagonal blocks here, which is the same mass as everybody else in here. They're not. Let's see those. Those would be gauge bosons that in turn have down quark into leptons. So that's something which could, you know, change quarks into leptons. You know that those things are around in their life. So this symmetry has to break, and it has to break at there's a lower bound as to where it can break. One way to get that lower bound is to say, well, we measure at lower energies. You know that G1 is not equal to G2, not equal to G3. They're kind of actually they're more like fists. And this has to be due to the normalization. You know, the couplings, as we come down in scale, we've seen that the couplings logarithmically were normalized, like QD. And so, different dimensions. Running. There. So typically, you know, 1 over g1 squared at some scale mu will be 1 over g1 squared at a different scale, mu naught, plus some coefficient b1 times logarithm of mu squared over mu naught squared, and so on for g2 and g3. And the sign of g1 will be positive or whatever it is for a coupling that grows at higher energies, because the helium coupling grows. These non-abelian ones fall at higher energies. So in a log-log plot, if you plot against log of mu, you plot 1 over g squared, then this will be a straight line, and the g1 will grow. I guess g1 starts off high and g, so g1 will be the one that goes down, because g is growing as we go to higher energies. And the SU2 and the SU3 will climb. And the thing is, they must be meeting at some point if they're. So this is a scale where, well, the M star, where the symmetry breaks. And the fact that we measure these values tells us, it gives us some idea as to where this is going to happen, because what these coefficients are will determine the slope, and that's going to be determined a little bit by what the particle content is here. But if we just had the standard model, we could just say, what happens if, where does this happen? And until, you know, about 10 years ago, if you took the standard model particle content and you ran it up, then within the errors, it did actually turn out to basically cross. But because the running is logarithmic, the place where they cross is actually exponentially large, given that these things are quite different. The electromagnetic couplings are quite different from the strong coupling. And so you're pointing to a scale which is exponentially large. You're asking where they all cross. Typically, you get something which is called the gut scale, which is something like 10 to the 15 or 10 to the 16 GeV. So it's very, very high compared to the standard model because this running is only logarithmic. And then a check on the whole thing, which is very pretty, is that these things that we're not seeing, you know, these exhaust diagonal gauge bosons that would mediate transitions from quarks to leptons, they can make a proton decay. And so, you know, we've seen already that in the standard model, I guess we haven't seen that, but it's true in the standard model that the baryon number and lepton number, the quantum numbers that keep the proton from decaying are just accidental consequences. If you write down the most general thing, not demanding they be baryon number invariant, the standard model, it happens that the things that are normalizing just happen to be baryon number invariant. So there's nothing intrinsic in the stability of the proton that says that higher energies have to preserve baryon number, and here's an example of a theory which doesn't. But the decay rate of the proton you can calculate as a function of this mass, and it turns out that the observational limit as far as this mass phi this bigger or higher, so the mass that you'd be pointed to by the absence of proton decay is similar to the mass you'd be pointed to by the couplings meeting. And about 10 years ago, people, as measurements at left got better, the values of these couplings got measured better, and then in the standard model what they found was that they really don't quite unify, they do something like that. But the second observation people made was that if somewhere around here you replace the standard model particles by their supersymmetric, if you added a supercharger for everybody, and you added the extra kinks that you need for the supersymmetry, then they run a little bit differently, and then they do unify it. So whether that means anything or not, you know, two lines had to meet, so the third line is up to you whether you think it's means anything or not. But that's kind of an interesting observation that the couplings do seem to converge at a point if you assume that something about the particle content about the weeks ago.
Flip. This running, does it depend a lot on how many loops you're doing?
There are loop corrections to it, but they, you know, because it's a loop expansion, they get stolen from work.
But over the large scales you have, does it matter not enough to make them closer to moving?
When they do this, for the experimental issue, so you're asking if the error is bigger than experimental errors.
Yeah.
When they do the comparison, they don't use just the one loop thing, they do the two loops and higher. And it's within the accuracy. The theoretical errors are as small as, so the agreement is within both the theoretical and the experimental errors, and they're not. The errors aren't outrageously large. So it's not like the errors like this or something. There's really content. That's how you can tell the standard model didn't mean. Because the fact you can exclude the standard model mean means you've got control over the errors.
So do you need those higher loop corrections to get those lines to cross exactly?
No, the thing that's changing is the values of these b's depend on the. Remember, the b here for QED counted the electron and the muon and whatever particle that you thought was lighter than in your effective theory. So these are sensitive to the particle content you have. So if you use the standard model particle content, they don't meet, but if you use the supersymmetric standard model content, you can use this thing over here. Provided that they're running from the weak scale up to the high scale. So the whole point of the story was not so much to sell you on these models, but that here's a kind of physics that has attractive features to it. And the kind of physics points you towards a particle content. Things should be organizing themselves into up here, they should be in SU5 multiplets. They aren't necessarily respecting the same selection rules you have at low energies, in particular protons might decay. So there's no reason why you should be assuming that the low energy limit is the first thing you should ask is why does the low energy limit look like protons are almost stable? And the standard model has an answer for that. As long as everybody you're adding to the theory is very heavy, then the low energy limit will look like it's a preserving Murray number, provided the scale of the stuff that's filing Murray number is sufficiently large. And we can check that later on by looking at dimension 6, dimension 5, and then non-normalized interactions, asking when's the first time you see proton decay. Right? And you'll see that it captures the kind of things you get from these kind of theories quite nicely. But you're pointing to a high scale in this particular case.
Sorry, I think that, what have
we gone? I haven't made that clear yet, so I'll explain that when I get there. But so far, I've been talking about the standard model, things out to the normalizable level, so that are unsuppressed by this heavy mass. And so, and the statement is that if you take the more general things, you can write down that are gauge invariant involving the standard model particle content, and just take what you get. That is the standard model, and that for free turns out to also be variant number preserving and lambda number preserving. So you didn't ask for them to be invariant, but they are invariant. But if you start writing down the non-normalizable things, that's no longer true. So at some point, when you write down dimension 5 or dimension 6 or things that are suppressed by whatever m, you'll find that you can write down things that predict lambda number and variant number. And so that says that that one way it could work is it might just be that there's nothing special about variant number or lambda number. It just happens that, given the particle content we have at low energies, there's just nothing which is consistent with gauge invariance at low energies that can violate lepton number or variant number, so by accident, the proton happens to be stable. And the fact that you can write down things that are suppressed by masses is saying that there could be a process at high energies which makes the proton decay, but it doesn't necessarily involve some particle whose couplings are breaking variant number, and that thing is very heavy, and so the scale in the denominator those effective interactions will correspond in some fundamental theory to some particle that whose couplings broke variant number. Like these ones. The ones in this particular theory, these guys would do that. Gauge bosons correspond to the outer number. So you'd expect, in this case, because these are bosons, you get things which go like 1 over the mass squared in the amplitude because the propagator is going to go like 1 over the mass squared in the low energy. And that would correspond in the effective theory to something which was dimension 6 because it had a 1 over mass squared. And you'll see that that's the first place to write down variant number violation. So, but the point of the exercise is not this. So here's an idea of what physics could be. It comes to you with an idea of the spectrum, and it comes to you with an idea of what the energy scales are. And so now we can ask this question more focused way. So how big, as we have a picture of what the thresholds are, so let's go through and integrate out particles and just see what happens. And so in particular, what I'm going to do is integrate out this guy. So whatever this guy is, he's some color scalar, which is heavy because we haven't seen him. And we'll integrate him out and see how he affects the effective coupling C2. So we've got some scale M5. And below here, we'll imagine we've got the effective field theory. And above here, we've got some effective theory, which is really some effective field theory for what we're going on at even higher scales. So in here somewhere, we have this term C naught H dagger H, or C2 is called H dagger H, and we also have C naught. And up here, we have similar terms. There's a C naught hat, there's a C2 hat, H dagger H. And typically, if we're really at the gut scale, H and phi come together as a five-component object, so we expect to get something like H dagger H plus phi dagger phi. If we're at the gut scale, because that's SU5 invariant. And you'd expect to get something at the quartic level, which would be E dagger H plus phi dagger phi squared, and so on. But we know that something must break the symmetry badly, because we know that these guys and these guys don't have the same mass, because these guys are not light, and these guys are. These guys have a negative coefficient at low energies, and that's why the Higgs gets an expectation value. But these guys better not be an expectation value, or they break color, because they carry color. So something happens above this scale which makes these things different. So when I write this theory down, it won't be the full grand unified theory. It will be another effective field theory too, and up here somewhere will be the grand unified theory. And I don't care about how this happens. So there's some Higgs that gives you Gauss which breaks the SU5 and gives masses to some things. And in that process, it gives you a term here, which is a different size. And I don't care how that happens. because I'm going to ask a question that happens at lower entropies. And then it'll also make these stuff a little different, and I don't really care about them so much. But let's suppose that in here somewhere, in this, I should have said, in this term h dagger h plus phi dagger phi squared, that has a piece which is h dagger h squared. It has a piece which is phi dagger phi squared. It also has a piece which is phi dagger phi h dagger h. And they would have had the same coefficient if the symmetry had been unbroken. But if I don't make these guys the same, I can't afford to make these guys the same. So let's just imagine the lambda hat, lambda phi hat, and call this phi g. So what we're supposed to do is we're supposed to calculate some process here and calculate the same process here and match. And demand, and we'll determine these coefficients down here by asking this theory, reproduce the answer to this theory, given that this theory doesn't have the phi particle in it. So the calculations won't be exactly the same because there's no phi particles in this lower energy theory. And so we have to compensate for that absence of phi particles by choosing these guys, these coefficients a little bit differently than we do here. And so we do all this in dimensional regularization. We'll normalize the minimal subtraction or the decoupling subtraction where we use minimal subtraction, but we only keep track of the particles in our effective theory. And when we cross the threshold, we normalize with only the particles in the new effective theory. So we'll do the whole decoupling subtraction story that I told you about before. And so in that calculation, you know, there's several kinds of graphs that could give you things. You can get things like, what I want to follow is I want to follow the thing that's the most sensitive to M, and it's basically this graph again. So if I look at this graph in the full theory, where this is the Higgs, and this is the heavy guy, phi, and this is the coupling here, G, and this graph is going to give a contribution which goes like, there's a factor of, it's a first order graph. So it's just a factor of I, guess. Being Lagrangian, so be that's the potential. And we're looking at this potential of Lagrangian. That's the potential of a minus I. Now there's two ways in which we can connect the Higgs up here. Actually, there's only one way to think of it being complex. Then there's a factor of G, the vertex. Then there's a loop, which is the integral. And if I'm in n dimensions for dimensional regularization, I'll have 2 pi. N, 1 over b squared plus n squared I. And I could have had any momentum flowing in has to be flowing out, so there's no momentum, none of the external momentums in the loop here. So this is just going to give a contribution for the potential. And the external line will just be times h dagger h. So you can imagine I'm just calculating the coefficient of phi, which is the h mass. And the corresponding calculation down here would have been just this interaction C2. The factors. There's again going to be a minus I, C2, and that's it. And so what's going to happen is when I match, is I'm going to learn that this guy is going to equal this guy. But as before, this is diverging. It's dimensionally regularized so there'll be a pole somewhere. So this thing will be something like minus I, g. The angular integrals will give me something like pi to the n over 2 divided by gamma n over 2. There's a 2 pi to n running around from the measure here. Then I've got an integral over the modulus of p. So the integral of p to the n minus 1 dp. Put that by p squared plus n squared. Infinity. And that's an integral which is I can think of as a gamma function. So this thing is going to evaluate to something like gamma over the n over 2, gamma of 1 minus n over 2 divided by gamma of 1. And I didn't pull it from my head, but I did this last night preparation for class, if I remember this. But what you're more or less living off of is the gamma function, the beta function b of x, y, which is gamma x, gamma y, over gamma of x plus y. It's even better 1 over that. That has a representation which is 0 to 1 t to the x minus 1, 1 minus t to the y minus 1 dt. So you can do a change of variables, which makes this look like this.
T equals to 1 over T equals 1, that's not bad. So, this is ultimately what you're using to do this integral, to write it that way. And what will count is the x and y will be these powers, and that's going to be related to the power of this denominator and the power appearing here, and that's kind of where the m is coming from. So really that 1 is because there's, if we'd had the squared here, this would have been a 2. Because there's only 1 power of p squared plus m squared, we have a 1 here. And the n over 2 is the power coming from this, and that's the, those are these two powers here. And this thing here is the same 1. So I was just saying, if we had had a d here, and we would have had d here and d here. So in dimensional regularization, you see that we're interested in d equals 1. So when n is 4, 4 over 2 is 2, and so 1 minus 2 is minus 1, and the gamma function has a pole at 0 and all the negative integers. So gamma it's minus 1 plus epsilon is minus 1 over epsilon plus finite stuff. Because epsilon goes to 0. And that's the infrared, that's the ultraviolet divergence of this graph is showing up as that pole in that gamma. So the bottom line is so that if the result of doing this graph is giving us a contribution to minus I g over 16 pi squared. So if I take this is a 2 pi to the fourth, and then this is pi squared, so that's giving me 16 pi squared. There's some numbers, which I'm not going to keep track of. This is gamma of 2, which is 1. This is the pole, which is minus 1 over epsilon. The thing I forgot to give on dimensional grounds, this thing has to have something with a scale in it. So this goes like p to the m minus 2. And so the only scale in this integral in dimensional regularization is m. So this has to go like m to the m minus 2. And if we've done this with a d here, the m minus d, 2d, I guess. So if d were 2, this would be n minus 4, which would be vanishing when n goes to 4 in that cycle. This is a block dimensional cycle, but we're interested in the case that this power goes to 2. But so n minus 2d, n minus 2 for us is going to be 2. In fact, if I write n is equal to 4 minus 2 epsilon, which is the epsilon that's going to appear here, then n minus 2 is 2 minus 2 epsilon. And so this I've got an epsilon-dependent power of m here, which if I take m to the 2 minus 2 epsilon and write that as being m squared e to the minus 2 epsilon log of m squared, and this is m squared 1 minus 2 epsilon log of m squared plus order epsilon squared. And the thing is, this epsilon will hit this pole and give me a finite piece, which I want to keep track of. And if you ask what makes the dimensions work, it's the story that we had before in dimensional regularization that these coupling constants were dimensionless, but only in 4 dimensions. In higher dimensions, these things have the engineering dimension of mass to some power which vanishes as n goes to 4. So we should really have, if we want to keep this dimensionless, we should really have written a mu to the four minus n here. And so that if I follow along the same argument, this should be this 1 minus n minus 4 log mu. And so what will happen here is I'm going to get a term which is
Is it pretty sure about this 2 in the exponential?
It should be let me just write this and then come back. Which two?
So you say it's e to the minus 2 epsilon log m squared. So the 2 in the m squared is this.
Oh, right, no.
Okay.
So there's stuff I'm not following here. There's a number, probably a number up front here. But the things I want to keep track of are the 4 pi, the couplings, the masses, and then this log. So when I write this out, what I'm supposed to do is I'm supposed to normalize this to minimal subtraction. So I'm supposed to subtract a counter term, which basically cancels that, and maybe some of these constants here, but it doesn't cancel this. So I'm going to be left with some renormalized thing. Pi squared, 1 minus, this pole will hit this pole over here, 1 plus the log of n pi squared over mu squared. So this is a renormalized guy that I'm supposed to compare to the renormalized guy down here, C2. C2 will be some number whose, I can't have some order of one number whose value I haven't calculated carefully times G. N pi squared, 16 pi squared, and there'll be some running involved, 1 plus log squared. So when mu is equal to n pi squared, then the coupling will be this, and as we come down, and from, you know, so C, this is giving you C2 as a function of mu. As we come down to lower scales, this thing is running logarithmically, but the important thing for what I want to say now is that when we matched across this threshold, we've got a contribution which is going up a positive, big positive power of mass, but it was an honest to God physical mass. So the calculation was similar in detail to this calculation, but the main difference was we're tracking a physical mass here, and so we understand what this coefficient is. But the understanding of this coefficient is specific to the theory in which we derived it, and that kind of underlines that the coefficient here, you can't understand this coefficient. The coefficient of this large scale, without knowing what the physics was, that you were integrating out, it's something that's below energy theory by itself can't tell you. The point is that C2 of mu will be equal to, I should have said that this is the change in C2 in this graph. There's also a direct piece coming from C2 in the high energy theory. So if this is the guy that we measure to be 100 GeV squared, and it's a normalized thing, so it makes sense to say that it's on scale. So C2, say at mu of order of the Higgs mass, is being measured that day. Then the fact that M phi is so large, we don't know exactly how large, but it's plausibly similar in scales to the SC5 breaking, because if it was light, it would start to screw up this running argument. And this running argument didn't include the Higgs partner. If the Higgs had been combined with its partner, then an SC5 invariant multiplet will not make these guys change relative to one another. So that'll move around where the value of the coupling at that high, that point where it makes is where it means, but it won't change by the mean. And you could argue that this thing's not so sensitive to different kinds of particles, but the calculation done here assumes that this six particles are heavy. So if that's a very large scale, so if this is at the gut scale, say, then there's going to be a huge cancellation happening between this thing and this guy to get the small number we see. And so if there's only one threshold, you might say, well, that's light. But the naturalist problem is that there's probably a shitload of thresholds out there, right? Because there's a lot of particles out there. And so what you're really going to do is you're going to imagine that your whole theory comes to you. Yeah, you'll have N1, N2, N3, N4, all the way down. Somewhere way down here is the Wien scale. So up here would be the Planck scale, say. Maybe the Planck scale above that. And we have to do this exercise at every step, matching across these thresholds. And so we're going to expect that so somebody gives us C2, what do we call this, star here, and then we derive from that C2 hat, which would be C2 star plus some coefficient, which is of order some number times, m left squared. And then we do that again here, and we get that C2 hat is C2 hat plus another number times m1 squared, because we integrated this guy. And we're going to keep on doing that all the way down until finally we get down here to C2 with no hat, so this is C2 at the Wien scale, is whatever the previous one was,
plus the last mass squared. And so the thing is that for generic theory, what you'd expect is that there's going to be some enormous conspiracy to get a small number here. We have to have an enormous number here, which is precisely adjusted to cancel this guy off, and then to cancel this guy off, and then cancel this guy off, and cancel this guy off, and so on all the way down the way, to the 18 or 16 decimal places that you have to do to get the answer. I guess it's 26 decimal places. So that's logically possible. There's no one to say that that's not the way nature works. But the thing is that we know a lot about how effective field theories work in situations where we understand what all the high energy physics is. And so if you start at the weak scale and you work your way down, you go through all the particles we know, go through the W boson mass, go through the QCD scale, and we'll get down to atoms and molecules, you can get nuclei, atoms and molecules, macroscopic objects like this, the planets, object cosmology. In all of those hierarchies, it was never true that there was a small number which conspired to be small at long distances in this way. The only one example that we have that seems to work like that is the cosmological constant, which I'll get to in a second. But every other small thing, whenever we find a small parameter in the scales that we understand, it's always true that the smallest of that parameter has two aspects to it. An understanding of why that parameter is small has two aspects. One of it is, why was it small in the standard model, which is our most microscopic description? And then why did it stay small as we integrated out all these different particles to get down to the scale where it was measured? And in all cases, that answer, both those things have answers. And that if you ask, at any scale that you choose to ask the question, why is this parameter small, it always has an answer. And you can ask the question at any scale you like, and it has a convincing answer at every scale you like. And if you decide to ask the question here, integrate things down to here, at every step along the way you understand why this parameter is small. So for example, if you want to know why are atoms bigger, much bigger than nuclei, and the size of an atom is set by Bohr radius, which is set by 1 over alpha ME, and the size of the nucleus, in the standard model, it would be set by the QCD scale. And so if you ask now, why is this scale small? The issue is, why is alpha small? Why is the ratio Ln over A0 much less than 1? The answer at this scale would be, is because the fine structure constant is small and the electron is much lighter than the QCD scale. But let's say you integrate out through the QCD scale down to the theory of nucleons and QED. Let's go down to the QCD scale. In this low energy theory below the QCD scale, A0 is still set by 1 over alpha E, and the size of the nucleus is now set by basically 1 over the mass of the proton. And so if you ask, in going from here to here in the matching, should I have expected alpha and ME to change by a whole bunch? The answer is no, because when I match alpha gets logarithmic corrections all the time. So 1 over, let's call this alpha hat here, 1 over alpha at low energies is 1 over alpha hat plus some logarithm of the scales we integrated out here. And that logarithm won't change things. If alpha, 1 over alpha is 137 or 128, this will be 137, say, but it's not going to be 10 to the minus 6 or something like that. So because it's changing logarithmically, as you go through the threshold, it's not a big deal, it's changing the alpha. And so the smallness here is related to the smallness here. And a similar thing is true for the electron mass. If you look at changes to the electron mass due to, say, muons, or charged particles that are very heavy, and you ask, what's the correction to the electron mass in this case? The change to the electron mass turns out to be the electron mass divided by 16 pi squared times 1, 2, 3, 4 factors of E, so that's alpha squared, times a logarithm of the muon mass divided by the electron mass. So again, it's logarithmic, and that's because there's a symmetry. If the electron mass had been zero, then there's a new symmetry in the problem, which is the chiral symmetry, where you rotate the electron by a gamma 5 transformation. And that symmetry, the preservation of that symmetry forbids radiative corrections from getting a mass. And so in that case, you couldn't get anything non-zero. The answer for the change in the mass had to vanish when the mass vanishes, because in that limit, the symmetry protected it. So that tells you that the correction to the mass had to be proportional to the mass. And then again, that means that on dimensional grounds, everything else that's left is logarithmic. And logarithmic changes are not dangerous.
So if you take something like this and ask threshold through threshold, if I understand it here, can I understand it at all other scales? It's true that you can understand it at all scales. You can ask the question at any scale you like, and then you can ask why it's stable as you go through various thresholds. And it's always true in the case that we understand that these hierarchies really are stable in this way. So the statement for the hierarchy problem, for the Higgs mass, would be that we should take that as a guideline, that a fairly conservative thing to ask of physics about the weak scale would be that this process of going through thresholds doesn't do this. It doesn't, for some reason, the corrections we get shouldn't be bigger than the weak scale squared, so that we can, at any scale we choose to ask the question, we have an answer as to why the weak scale is so slight compared to the scale. So we don't have, until we understand this physics, we can't understand, you know, there were two parts to the understanding of the smallness of ratio. One was, why does God give you the small number in the first place? And the second thing is, why does it stay stable as you go through these thresholds? The first part we can't answer until we get up to the energies that God works out. But the second part we can, because that's something which is a low energy problem. As soon as you're above the weak scale, you have a problem. So whatever it is that happens above here, in this region, should be constrained by the requirement that as you go through thresholds down here, those thresholds don't screw up the smallness of this number. And so the utility of these technical naturalist arguments is that they're telling you something about the energies that you almost have reached for. Because whatever the physics is that's here, a good motivation or how to organize how to think about what it is that it should be something for which this process of matching doesn't give you large contributions, whatever it is. And the point is that it has to happen here, not here, and so that's the place where you're going to be able to test it. The ultimate reason why the numbers turned off small is something you maybe won't understand until you're in the full theory up here, and that's life. You may get lucky and understand it here, but you may not. But the technical naturalist argument is saying there's information at the low energies, which is the important thing to follow. So let me, everything that people look for at the LHC breaks into, there's three classes of ways in which you can make things natural in a sense. And that kind of organizes how you think about what the options are in the LHC model. So let me do that after a short break. That's going longer than I want to do for the break. I'm going to break very often. So why don't you come back in 5 minutes and then